We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic, and I also did a lot of drugs. My sobriety date is August 19th, 1983. I am a war baby, which means that in 1945, when my dad came home from the Second World War, along with every other GI, 9 months later, I was born. My first remembrance of being a person, I was about 4 years old. We lived in Newton Falls, Ohio. And this new little development that we lived in Newton Falls, Ohio, on Elizabeth Street, 229 Elizabeth Street, was part of probably a 10 to 15 house little development. And my parents, along with every other parent on the block, were grateful that the Second World War was over and it was party time. And I can't tell you how many times I woke up in the middle of the night and there would just be loud talking and laughing going on in the living room and the kitchen. And well, that's basically the house, because like there was living room, kitchen, and two bedrooms. That's it. And quite often I'd wake up in the middle of the night because somebody would be in bed who had drunk too much with me. And nothing happened. It was just that they were too drunk and they climbed into bed with me to sleep it off for a while. And that was just the norm. I can remember many times also waking up in the middle of the night and the house would be empty because they had moved the party to somebody else's house because maybe my parents ran out of liquor and the neighbors had some. So they all went over there. And I'll also never forget waking up in the morning and coming out of the living room and seeing all these half full glasses sitting on the tables. And I started to notice that a glass made a white ring on the wood table. And some of the glasses would have cigarettes in them and some wouldn't. And some would be half full and some would be nearly empty. And I'm sure being a kid, I probably took a sip to see what was in there. I did not drink from the ones that had cigarette butts, I can tell you that. But I'm sure that I probably took a sip of the other ones. I lived in a typical small town of that era, and all us kids ran in packs, played all sorts of outdoor games. And in the morning, we left the house. And in the evening, when the sun started to come down, we came back home. I went fishing a lot in the Mahoning River, which was behind our house. And I used to love to go fishing. And I would always make myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. After I had dug for worms, my hands were black with mud and some of my fingernails. I would make peanut butter and jelly. But that's just the way it was back then. I went to a local Catholic grammar school named St. Mary's. I was being raised Catholic. The thing that struck me first about being raised Catholic was it was extremely important. My parents wanted me to be in a Catholic school, and the nuns in the school wanted me to be in church every Sunday, which I was, and I became an altar boy. But it was not on my parents' radar to go to church. But fortunately, we lived really close to the church, so I would just walk there every morning that I had. I went there every Sunday, but I also go when I also was going to be an altar boy, and I was an altar boy for several years. We lived in Newton Falls from the time I was 4, or could have even been 2 years old, but 4 for me, until I was 9 or 10. And we moved to Columbus, Ohio. And mom said that dad had been transferred, and that's why we were moving. Going to a new school is never fun. Yeah, I just learned right away. Because you will be bullied. But if you stand up for yourself and just whoever's bullying you, fight them immediately. Don't wait till after school. Don't wait till later. Fight them right now. And that way, everybody else leaves you alone. Win or lose, it doesn't matter. You're never really hurt that bad. but the bullying stops because they know you're not going to take it. And I'll never forget when we checked into, because again, it was important that I go to a Catholic grammar school. We checked into whatever parish it was. We went to the church and the priest said, "You are not going to be one of these parents that checks your kid into school and then we never see you again. You are both going with me over to the church right now. You are going to make confession, and which is part of the Catholic protocol. You're going to do confession, and I will see you all every Sunday in church." It was called Christ the King School and probably Christ the King Parish. I'll never forget going over to the church right then and there, and my dad kneeling down in the church and with his head buried in his hands. And I had this feeling of hope in me, like maybe things will be different, because my remembrance of him in Newton Falls was every single night he had a glass of bourbon, Jim Beam, and a beer. And then the evening ended with usually him and mom getting into a fight. And when I saw him in church with his head buried in his hands and going to confession, I just thought, well, maybe things will be better. Maybe this is what we need. It was, of course. I went to that school one year, and we went to church every Sunday, and Dad cut down on his drinking and put on, he got fat. He just plain old got fat. And after that year, they pulled me out of that school and put me in the public school, which this public school was really kind of nice. Not much bullying going on. Some, but I mean, you just deal with it and move on. So I went to Shady Lane Grammar School. My parents were still partying. It was still, the neighbors would come over and drink, and I'd wake up some mornings, they'd still be up drinking, because I believed that diet pills were now coming on the scene, which kept them up all night. That's the way it was in Columbus. Nothing major happened there from Columbus. Dad gets transferred again. Yep, Dad gets transferred. And then we moved to Whitehall, Maryland. And we lived on a dairy farm. We rented it. The home was like the main home of the dairy farm. And Mr. and Mrs. Russell, who we rented from, were neighbors, and that was the main home. And they lived in a home right next door. When I say right next door, like a couple hundred feet away. This home was built in 1810, and I just love this home. They called it a four-square colonial. And then I checked into high school there. I actually had a pretty good time in that school. I started working out with weights. I loved milking the cows, and I loved baling the hay and putting the hay in the barn. I actually had a horse there that I saved money. I worked for Mrs. Russell because she owned the farm and saved my money. And I bought a Tennessee walking horse. And Mr. Burns, who was a neighbor, allowed me to keep it on his land as long as he said there's some fencing on it, but if you'll finish out the fencing, it's about 30 acres. He said, you can keep your horse on this pasture. And he had a barn there too. So I did. I did that. My horse's name was Red, and I would ride Red and ride him bareback, and he and I were buddies for a couple of years, and then Dad gets transferred again. We're off to Glen Ellyn, Illinois. I checked into St. Procopius Academy, and then one more time I'm in a new school again, and all that goes with it. At this point, I was kind of like, you know, I'm kind of like done, you know. I'm done with the moving. I'm done with trying to fit in. You know, I'm done with the BS. That's when I took my first drink. Me and Brian Duffy, we would go drink and then go to like the basketball games or go to the sock hops with dances. And then I also got a job at the local grocery store, Jewel Tea Foods, on Roosevelt Road in Glen Ellyn. I saved my money and I bought a car. I bought a 57 Chevy. And I loved that car. That car was a romper stomper. I put a 327 engine in it. I think I paid maybe $200 for it at the time, 327, and it was really fun. I graduated from high school there, barely. At this point, I could care less about most anything. I had a job. I made decent money. And I could move out. The day I turned 18, I left. I was gone. And rented a room in a rooming house with a couple of guys that I knew from Jewel T. Vietnam is heating up. This is like 1964, 65. I graduated in 64. Vietnam is like really heating up and guys are getting drafted to go to Vietnam. Me and Butch Feldman and Bob Buck decided, well, let's travel the country because we know we're going to get drafted. And we took Bob's Volkswagen. I think it was a 61 or 62 Volkswagen. And the three of us left to go to the World's Fair in upstate New York at the time. I think this was 65. We never made it. We didn't make it to Niagara Falls. And then we traveled down the Eastern Seaboard and we would stay with obscure relatives. We would just show up and say, here we are. People were so kind. I mean, so accommodating, loving, kind. Of course, you're welcome. Feed us. Take us out. I'll never forget this one family. They were Butch's relatives. Were so kind. And so, like, I'll never forget how they were. I'll never forget their hospitality and their loving kindness. I know now that they were strong Christian folk. And I just, it meant a lot. So Bob, Butch, and I traveled the country. We stopped off in Cumberland, Maryland, at the Cumberland Gap. We stopped off in a little diner. We got to talking with this older couple who's probably my age now or even less, a husband and wife. And they invited us in, and we stayed with them for 2 weeks. They were so wonderful. At the end of that 2 weeks, we headed back to Chicago. I enlisted in the Navy. Bob got drafted, and Butch did not. Butch got married and didn't have to serve. Bob went to Vietnam, so did I. I asked for naval aviation because my dad was a Second World War pilot. And they gave me naval aviation. I went to Oceana Naval Air Station in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I really liked it. I really did. Our squadron was F-4 Phantoms, fastest fighter jet in the world at the time. And I worked in maintenance control. And I drank, but not to excess. But I was on the road. You know what I mean? I was definitely on the road. At that point, I still had some semblance of control over it. We went to Vietnam in 1967. And our ship, the USS Forrestal, blew up off the coast of North Vietnam, July 29th, 1967. I thought that day I was sure I was going to die. Along with 51 other guys from my squadron who did die, I said my prayers, and I expected to die with the next bomb blast, but it didn't happen. I lived. I was actually rescued from the compartment that I was in. And then like an hour, once I was rescued, I went and got some water and then went up to the hangar bay and helped push the bombs over the side and fight the fire, which had now gone down 8 decks into the ship. And it was like all hands on deck to save the ship. That went on for 24 hours, roughly. We went back into Subic Bay, Philippines, and I got so drunk that night that I don't even remember. And then what's funny is the last reunion I was at, Jeff Thompson said that they were coming back from along a post city, and I was in the passed out in the shore patrol station. They walked through there on their way back to the base through that guard shack, and they saw me. And they told the shore patrol, hey, he's with us. He's one of us. So they said, good, get him out of here. And I don't even remember that at all. I served 4 years in the military, Fighter Squadron 11, got out. I went to college at Skyline Junior College in south of San Francisco. I went to San Francisco because my parents were living there. I was discharged in Virginia Beach and then drove there. Drove to Albuquerque and then took the train from Albuquerque to San Francisco. me and Tony Fleming have driven this car. They had this thing called Drive Away, where you would deliver a car and then hopefully be able to get a car to your destination. We did not, though. So we got my parents actually footed the bill for us to take the train from Albuquerque to San Francisco. There, drinking started pretty regularly, and I drank blackout drunk. And many nights I would wake up in my car, not even know how I got there. You know what I mean? And that was pretty bad off. I went to college for 1 year. I went to Skyline Junior College. When I was at Skyline Junior College, I really tempered the drinking. And what amazed the heck out of me was I was 4.0 in school, which was amazing to me because I barely graduated. But then again, in high school, I skipped class. I didn't do the homework. I was arrogant. I was a pain in the ass to anybody who instructed me. And when I went to college, I went to class. I just did the work assigned to me. And I was 4.0. So I was kind of, I'll never forget, I was surprised at that. I went there for 1 year, and I just thought, this is a complete waste of time. Even then, in 1970, two of the professors were real, like, anti-war activists. And, you know, friends of mine had died in that war, you know. And I just thought, you know what, I don't need this. I'm going to go to work. I like working. I'm good at it. Jim Bentley, he was a buddy of mine. He just passed away about a month ago. He said, Coors Beer is looking for a salesman. Come on down and go to work. So I went down to Long Beach, California. I applied at Shoreline Beverage. Got the job at Coors. I was I repaired all the draft systems in all the bars, which was perfect for me. Because then they had to be tested. You know, I had to make sure they taste test. After I cleaned all the taps out and put new O-rings and anything else they might need to make them function properly. And I got a job bartending at night at a bar called The Other Place, and which is no longer there. So I saved money. I bought a home. I bought a home on the GI Bill. I stayed at my parents' house. My parents were now living down there. My dad had been transferred to Long Beach, or not to Long Beach, to LA. And he was living in Long Beach. And I stayed with my parents for 2 months and saved every penny I made. And all I had to pay was the closing costs to buy the home. And I bought the home at 330 Argonne Avenue in Belmont Heights of Long Beach. I paid $25,500 for it. There was a house in back, one bedroom, one bath, and a house in front, two bedrooms, one bath. And I rented out the front house. And I lived in the back house. After Vietnam, I went to the Mediterranean. And while I was in the Mediterranean on board the Forestall, after it had been repaired, I met people from France. So now that I'm living in Long Beach, in my own home, people from France that I had met there, actually, they weren't the people that I had met there. They were friends of the people that I met there, came to visit me in Long Beach and would spend a couple months with me. And it was just really fun. I got to practice my French and drinking, of course. And now pot is part of the equation in our everyday lives then. And I was bartending and working at Coors. And it was a lot of fun. It was just fun, you know. The third year in a row that they came to visit me, they stopped off in La Paz, Bolivia, before they came to L.A., and they brought with them 2 kilos of cocaine in their camera equipment, packed in it. And this is maybe 75 right in there. And, of course, I tried cocaine. I had seen cocaine used in this movie called Easy Rider. And here we have a whole roasting pan full of it. So I tried it, and I absolutely loved it. I loved it. I could stay up all night, shower, go to work, feel fresh as a daisy, and feel exceptionally with it mentally. And anyway, yeah, that's the lure. That's the kick. And boy, did that put me on the train to hell. They wanted to sell it. They wanted to sell the cocaine and take back all the cash. And I didn't, you know, here's the way my thought process was. I dealt with 5 different strip clubs all around Los Angeles International Airport. So I went into the strip clubs because I knew everybody there. And I would go to the manager. I said, "You want to buy some cocaine?" And everybody was eager to try it. but not one person bought it. My friends from France ended up mailing it home, and I never heard from them again. To this day, I've never heard from them again. So I can only imagine they got busted and things didn't go well. But boy, did that put me on the train. Uppers. Uppers, cocaine, booze, and it was the perfect combination. I started dealing cocaine. During this time, I left Coors and I went to work for Budweiser. And the company was called Somerset Distributors at the time. And it's no longer around. But it was owned by Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra owned the company. And he was a super duper guy to own the distributorship. My company car was a Pontiac Bonneville convertible. Can you believe that? My boss's company car was a Jaguar. I mean, we were unlike any other beer distributorship on the planet. I mean, he was just wonderful to us. And we got to go to all the favorite, all the functions, all the Hollywood functions. He would buy, you know, the whole table in like these big gala events. The table could cost $10,000. And this is in the 70s. And we would go. And he would pay for the tuxedo rental for us. And it was just absolutely fun, super fun. You know, life has consequences, you know, when you start to have fun all the time and alcohol and drugs are involved. At some point, alcohol and drugs, they gain that upper hold on you, and they had on me. And I was dealing cocaine and buying and selling it. And one day I just decided I don't need to work anymore. I can make more money in 15 minutes than I can all week selling beer and wine. And I quit my job at Somerset, which now I had every day, all day to do drugs and drink. I'll never forget one day I had walked to Monpaul Grocery, which is still there in Belmont Heights. I was walking back with some food I bought. I come to my street and the street is blocked off with police car, you know, and I round to the corner. All my neighbors are standing out front and the SWAT team van is parked in front of my house. And the SWAT team guys with their M16 are walking in and out of my front door. And all my neighbors say, Jim, what's going on over there? And I said, well, looks like the SWAT team is there. And they said, aren't you going to go check that out? You know, and I said, no. You know, no, I don't think so. I think I'm leaving. And so I left, and then I called my neighbor. I went to the payphone at Monpaul's. I called a friend and went over to their house. And then about an hour or two later, I called my neighbor, Ray. And as soon as Ray answered the phone, he just said, and he heard my voice, he said, well, they're gone. So I came back home, and the thing of it was they had a report of shots fired. Of course, there was no shots fired, but they just knew I was a drug dealer and they created this charge, I'm thinking, to go in and see if they can see anything. But there was no roaches in the ashtray in my house. There was no mirror, no straw, nothing to lead you to believe that I did drugs or dealt drugs. And there was cocaine in the house. It was in the bathroom underneath the clawfoot tub and underneath the floorboards. But you wouldn't know that, you know, unless you knew that. Anyway, that following morning, I left and I went to Canada and I took cocaine with me, of course, and stayed in Canada for 30 days because I knew that's how long I'd be under surveillance at the time. Did the cocaine, met a bunch of people up there, party every day. Come back home and I met this one guy that said, hey, if you'll as much cocaine as you can bring up, we'll sell it. And I was getting a super price for it up there, way more than what I would get in California. So on my next trip up there, I get hammered on the plane, or I try to, but I couldn't. And I drank. I get off that flight in Calgary, Alberta, and it's almost like there was a reception committee waiting for me. I was pulled to the side, searched, grabbed my bag, searched that, strip searched. Found the cocaine. I had 36,000 in cocaine on me, and I was incarcerated, and I'll never forget that. I had $150 in cash on me, And I was going to give, I had $150 in cash in me, which was part of my personal property. The cocaine, of course, is gone. My house at this point was in foreclosure. Anyway, yeah. I mean, just all the wreckage that goes with that. I won't even call it a lifestyle, death style. So I'm in jail, and I was immediately charged with possession for sales. And unbeknownst to me, the narcs flew to Long Beach, investigated me, and they even went into my mom's antique shop. And she told me later, some years later, she says, I knew immediately when they came in that they were federal agents. She said, I just knew it. And by this time, she knew that I was in jail. I called her after I was in a few months. And of course, there was no bail for me. By the time I went to trial, it was like a year later. Anyway, they flew to Long Beach, investigated me, come back, call me down to the interview room. And they just said, you know what? You are a known drug dealer. You've even had the SWAT team at your house. People that you've supplied have been busted and point the finger right at you. They said, not only are we charging you with possession for sales, we're charging you with importation, which in Canada carries a 7-year minimum to life sentence. And I just said, I want to see my lawyer. And they laughed. They said, yeah, you're going to need him. And I went up to my cell. And for the first time in my life, for the second time in my life, I prayed again in earnest. The first time was when I knew I was going to die aboard ship. And then this time, I prayed with complete abandon. Please help me, Lord. Please help me. I've totally ruined my life. Please help me, Lord. Please help me. I don't know how many times I said it. I have no idea how long I said it. But at some point, I was filled with, I mean, I was completely possessed by an envelope of love and peace and understanding and protection that I had never felt in my life. And immediately for me at that point, God showed himself to me. I asked for his help and he showed up. He showed up. And his message from me that I received was, everything's going to be okay. You're with me now. You're going to be working for me and with me. And I immediately that next day went around to a few of the guys that I had been turning on to people in LA and just said, I just want you to know I am out of this. I'm out of this business. I'm not going to do drugs anymore at all, anywhere. And I'm done. And then they immediately said, are your people dead in the water? And I said, no, I'm not going to say anything about them to anybody, but I'm out. I'm done. And I went to the first chapel service that I heard about. I went, there was a Anglican priest named Father Pat, who's since passed away, but just a wonderful old guy, like put out to pasture at the county jail. And he had Parkinson's pretty bad, so he would rest his elbows on the card table, which was our makeshift altar in this room where we held chapel, and he would hold the chapel service. And I asked him if I could get a cross, and he brought a cross to me. I got a hold of a Bible, and I would read the Bible at night. And I worked out in the gym every day, and they had AA meetings. They would have AA meetings in the jail, and I would go. And I can't really tell you what I heard in those early meetings. I just knew that I'm glad I was there. I identified with what I was hearing from these men. And they were just men from AA who are doing God's work and bringing a meeting into jail. And what was another miracle for me, because nothing really changed for me inside. I will never forget this. I was the only American. I was the only Vietnam veteran. And for the inmates and the guards alike, the fact that I was a Vietnam veteran, they respected that. Because in Canada at that time, all they saw for the most part was draft dodgers. You know, here I am. I volunteered to go, and I did go to Vietnam. You know, and I lost my best friend along with 50 other guys from the squadron. My first job in jail, the guard said, you want a job? I said, yeah. They said, the pay's not much, but it'll keep you busy. This is an 8-floor jail, and the buffer goes side to side, you know, while they buff the linoleum. There's about a half inch of waxy buildup on each side of the hallways next to the baseboard. They gave me a scraper and said, scrape up the waxy buildup, which I did without complaint and on my hands and knees every day. And then time passed. I worked out every day. If there's chapel, I'm going. If there's an AA meeting, I'm going to that too. And after a while, I mean, everybody got to know me or know of me. The guard said, we're going to transfer you to the penthouse. It's the eighth floor. Up there, we're going to put you in charge. This is funny. We're going to put you in charge of the library. And all you have to do is sweep it twice a day. And I can assure you, the library doesn't really get dirty in jail. But anyway, I discovered these novels by Louis L'Amour, and he wrote about the Old West and the code of the men of the Old West. And it really taught me a lot about being a man, and I really enjoyed that. It was pretty cool. I became the dorm boss, not because I'm tougher than anybody else or everybody else, I'm not, but they just respected me. And I, of course, had been there longer than anybody else. So I knew the game. So every 3 or 4 days, I would have a meeting of all of the whole dorm and just lay out the rules for the new people on how to get along in here and not create problems for us or for yourself. At the end of every meeting, I would say, well, everybody happy? And I would always get a laugh out of that. And it was fun. At one point, one of the guards, or the guard on my floor, said to me, he says, you know how to cut hair? Because we haven't arrested a barber in a while, and we need a barber. And I said, well, I kind of did cut hair in the service. Service haircuts are a whole lot different than civilian haircuts, I can tell you that. Anyway, I became the barber. Becoming the barber, I got everybody's famous hair. I got told me their story. And I would always say, listen, I hear you. I hope you make it through okay. I hope they find you innocent. I said, but here's one thing that's really helped me. I said, I say this prayer every day as often as necessary. And here it is. Dear Lord, please give me the strength and the courage to make it through today. Amen. At that point, I wasn't as far along as I am now, so I didn't say in Jesus' name. I certainly do today. But I would say, dear Lord, please give me the strength and the courage to make it through today. Amen. Usually the guys that I cut hair, I wouldn't see them again because they had been out on bail, went to trial, got guilty. They were with us for a few weeks and then shipped off to whatever prison they were going to. So not very rarely, only one time did I actually cut a guy's hair for the second time. He said to me, he says, you know that prayer you gave me? He says, that really helped me. I said, good. I said, it sure helps me every day. I was in and out of court during that year many times, almost like to the point where I have an honorary law degree. So I'm on my way to court one more time, and I'm in the van, and I know, of course, the guard, and they take me to the behind the courthouse. They have cells back there. And in this one cell is this huge biker convict, built like a T-bone steak. He had stone gray hair, and I don't even think he was 35, and it came down to the middle of his back. He had a beard twisted down into two horns in the front, and he just looked, I mean, he's the reason there are prisons. this guy would strike terror in the heart of the average citizen. And I'll never forget, I elbowed the guard. I said, don't put me in there with him. And he laughed. He says, I have to, you're a prisoner. So I go in there with him, and I'm in my civilian clothes, and I have on these hand-tooled, total drug dealer cowboy boots that I was arrested in. And he takes one look at me, and he goes, man, he's not sure like them boots. I said, yeah, I do too. And the minute he heard me speak, he says, where are you from? I said, I'm from L.A. He said, wow. He said, what are you in on? I said, cocaine. And then I said, how about you? And he says, it's a murder beef. And I said, well, can they make you on it? He said, no, I didn't do it. I said, okay, good. All the best. Good luck. Anyway, he went his way. I went mine. Like a week, I'm not even sure if it was a week or what it was, but I'm on my way to chapel to see Father Pat. And all of a sudden I hear, hey, Jim. And I turn around and it's this guy. And his name was Spencer. And he says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to chapel. He said, can I go with you? I said, I was shocked. I said, yeah, of course. So we go to chapel service, and of course, here's Father Pat with the card table and a sheet across the front of it with the lettering, "Forgive us, for we are all sinners." And I, when I saw that the first time, I said, "Thank you, Lord, because yes, I certainly qualify." Anyway, Spencer sits down next to me, and we're in the front row because I need all I can get. And I still sit to this day almost in the front row of any church service. In the back of this room, there are actually guys who are not there to go to the chapel service. They're there to smoke, talk, laugh, and just totally disrespectful of what's going on. And Spencer is a big enforcer. He is a typical prison enforcer. He looks mean. He is mean. He is dangerous. He can hurt you. And sitting there, and I'm listening to these guys in the back laughing. Father Pat is just doing the Anglican Mass the way he always does. And I just, you know, I just said, "Damn, I wish to hell they'd shut up back there." Spencer turns around and he goes, "Shut the fuck up." And it was like you could hear a pin drop. And then I said, "I don't like him smoking either." And he says, "Butt out them fucking cigarettes right now." And every one of them dropped their cigarette, mashed it out. And we never heard another peep out of them. And I knew right then and there that when I did go to the, you know, the penitentiary, that in what when the muscle likes you, nobody messes with you. That was a big lesson. And around Christmas time or January, there was an article in the Calgary Herald called "Losing the War Against Drugs." And I just thought immediately, I'm going to write an article called "Winning the War Against Drugs." And I did. And I detailed my own involvement with drugs for 5 years or so. And that I was in jail awaiting trial, you know, and it totally ruined my life. And I allowed it to ruin my life. It's my stuff, self-responsibility. I gave the article to the guard. And I told him if he'd mail it to the Calgary Herald, I'd appreciate it. He did. The following Sunday, page 6, I can't remember if it was entitled "Winning the War Against Drugs" or "The Fight Against Drugs" by Jim Birmingham. And they didn't change one word of my article. And you know what else is funny? Because the Holy Spirit told me to write it, I did not proofread it for grammar or anything. I just wrote it just as I was inspired to write it. Gave it to the guard, and it ends up in the paper, just as I had written it. And the following Monday, I now have a court-appointed attorney named Simon Lord. And the following Monday, I get called down to the interview room. Here's Simon. He says, "Hey, Jimmy," says, "the prosecutor gave me your article here, pal." He said, "This is tantamount," his word, "tantamount to pleading guilty." I said, "Simon, I feel like God told me to write it, so I'm good with it." And he laughed. He said, "Okay, pal." He says, "But you will do the time." And I said, "You know what, Simon? I'm good with that, too. I'm good with all of it now. I'm going to live. I'm going to have a life." And he left. 3 days before I was to go to trial, the prosecutor comes to Simon and says, "You tell Jim if he'll plead to possession for sales, plead guilty, that we will drop importation and recommend 2 years. And I'll never forget asking Simon, I mean, of course, I was thrilled. And I said, "Simon, why is he doing that?" And he said, "Jimmy, he just doesn't think you're that bad of a guy." And the truth of it was that I had the best part of a year to develop a reputation, make a name for myself, and actually show that I was on the road to rehabilitation and a new life through the grace of God. I went to trial. It was a mere formality. I pled guilty. I was sent to Drumheller Federal in northern Alberta, spent 30 days in R&D, and then released in the mainline population. All the guys that I had cut hair and got to know me totally took care of me. Herbie Sampson and Frank Greenaway had a cell for me, had a cell mate for me, a good guy. They also had a place for me in the chow hall. And Herbie Sampson, who was another enforcer, simply said, "This is Birmingham, he's solid." And that's all it takes. "This is Birmingham, he's solid." Done. Nobody ever messed with me. Nobody. I immediately got to chapel. The AA meetings were inmate run because we were so remote. in northern Alberta, that they outside people rarely showed up to bring an AA meeting into the prison. I worked out every day, ran track every day. I knew I was going to do my basics, which kept me good. You know what I mean? Kept me on. Everything that I'm going to do in my life is going to benefit me and make me stronger. And that was my kind of battle cry. And so I was doing those things. The workouts, the chapel, the AA, reading the Bible, staying away from the drugs and alcohol, which is tricky in prison. Because if you go into somebody's cell and they're all smoking hash oil or weed oil back then, how do you get out of there without smoking it? If you don't smoke it, they think there's something wrong with it. And God protected me. I stayed away from it. I didn't want to be part of it because I knew where it would lead me. I'm there for 8 months. Frank Greenaway said, Jim, you want to get out of here? I laughed. Yeah, sure, Frank. How are we going to do that? He said, we're going to transfer. Put in for a transfer, and I went to Bowdoin Penitentiary, which was almost like nice. I joined Toastmasters. They had AA meetings from the outside all the time. They had a regular chapel service, choir. I did my workouts. Did I say I joined Toastmasters? I did. Anyway, it was actually really nice. I mean, you could go anywhere you wanted alone. Whereas in Drumheller, you always took other people with you. You never went anywhere alone. And I, of course, got to know everybody. And I was part of the inmate committee there. And I became the barber again, which was fun. Really fun. And they gave me scissors that actually had points on them. And which you never saw that anywhere else. All the pointy ends were all rounded. Anyway, I know the chaplain there. And he calls me into his office one day and he says, hey, Jim, I got bad news. And I laughed. I said, hey, chaplain, I'm in prison, pal. Okay, you got bad news for me. He says, no, I'm serious, Jim. And that's when he said, your dad is dead. He shot himself. And my dad was an alcoholic. He never got sober. I think he tried. Of course, he wouldn't do it with AA because he says, well, I can't help myself. How can anybody else help me? Which is completely flawed thinking. We all need help. Anyway, my dad got to the point he was miserable when he drank. He was miserable when he didn't. And he took his own life. I was floored. I couldn't believe it. And the irony is I got a letter from him the next day in prison. I got a letter from him the next day. There was nothing in that letter. I still have it. They would lead you to believe that he was going to do that. And he did. They arranged for a deportation hearing for me right away to deport me back to the U.S. to be with my mom, which was extremely kind of them. You know, they didn't have to do that. And again, I'm the only American in there. I'm the only Vietnam veteran. And I go to the deportation hearing. It's just men that are on that panel, like men from any neighborhood that are doing their service, they're being of service. They said, why should we allow you to go home before you finish down your sentence? And I said to them, I've changed myself physically, spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. I said, I haven't done anything financially, of course, but I will when I get out. I said, but I've changed myself in those four ways where I'm able right here for the better. One of the guys said, it says here you quit smoking. I said, yeah, I quit smoking 9 months after I was in. He was very impressed with that. To me, smoking was like nothing. Anyway, they granted my deportation. One of the guys looked at me and said, you know what? In all the years I've been doing this for parole, always, not deportation, for parole, he said, no one has ever said I've changed myself physically, spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. No one. I said, well, I have. You know, they replaced my plane ticket, and I had my simple trepidation or fear about coming home was now everything is exposed to me. Now I can go or do anything. So I just said, I'm going to do exactly what I did on the inside. I'm going to do the same on the outside. I'm going to go to chapel, church. I'm going to go to AA or Cocaine Anonymous or both. I'm going to work out. I did the deck of cards workout. You flip a card over, five push-ups, flip a card over, 10 jumping jacks. You know, whatever card you flip over, you run in place, stomach crunches, you name it. Guarantee you'll never make it through a deck. anyway, so I was going to do all the things on the outside that I did on the inside. I came home. My mom, of course, was a basket case because Dad had killed himself. I was able to drive Dad's car. I immediately got into the program. I went to a meeting every day, sometimes two a day. And I'll tell you this, it was not comfortable. I was not happy, joyous, and free. I was, wherever I was uncomfortable. I felt like a raw nerve ending. Even though I had, at this point, over 2 years of sobriety, I just kept going. I knew that there's no option for me. I have to keep going. I want to keep going. And if I'm uncomfortable, I'm uncomfortable. Oh, my Lord. Here's one story. I get a haircut. I'm home. I'm getting a haircut. The gal says, I haven't seen you before. I said, no, I'm new. And she said, how come? And anyway, she's questioning me. She said, do you go to any of the clubs? I said, no, I don't. And she said, I said, I don't drink. And she said, you don't drink. She said, do you do drugs? I said, no, I don't do drugs. And then she says to me, well, you smoke pot, don't you? I said, no, I don't smoke pot. And then she said, how do you have any fun? And I said, look, I don't have any fun, okay? I'm not having any fun. That put me on the path of I'm going to get hammered. I'm going to go to Houlihan's, which is no longer there, and because nobody knew me there, and I was going to get drunk. And then high and laid and all that goes with it. I pull into the parking lot there in Marina Pacifica, and I drive down one lane and the next lane, and I drive down I can't tell how many lanes. There wasn't one single open parking space. And I got to the end over there by the old, either Acapulco or whatever that Mexican restaurant was. I get down there at the end, and I literally look up and throw my hands up, and I say, dear Lord, thank you. Thank you. And I left there. I never had the obsession to drink or use again. And my life was saved that night, because if I had found a parking space and gone in, I'd be dead. No doubt about it. I was saved. God saved me. And looking back on it after all these years, there probably was a parking space or two or three. But the Holy Spirit blinded me to those spaces. I didn't see them. I threw myself into the program. No one would hire me. I get that. You know what I mean? If I saw a work truck on the street, I would stop the car, get out, say, whatever crap job you have, whatever it is, I'll do it for $5 an hour. And I got work every day doing that. And I can't tell you. One time, my job was to sweep the parking lot at Java Lanes, which is no longer there. Java Lanes Bowling Alley on PCH with a push broom. It's a huge parking lot, huge. And it's hot. Of course, sun always shining in Long Beach. I'm sweeping the parking lot. It gets to be about noon. I get on the payphone. I call Miles Evans, my sponsor. I said, Miles, this is bullshit. You know what I mean? I mean, I hate this. I want to leave. And he said, immediately, he said, hey, Jim, he said, God gave you that job, pal. God gave you that job. You do a good job. You do it with gusto. And he said, if you're bitching about what God has given you at this point, how in the hell do you expect him to give you any more if you're not grateful for what you have? And I just simply said, yes, sir. And hung up that phone. And I finished that entire parking lot for $5 an hour. You know what? I felt good about myself at the end of the day. I had accomplished something. I did not give up. I did not leave. And my journey back into the workforce had begun. I got a job with Tully Meats, no longer there, Gardena. I worked with Brian Tully, who trained me. I sold meat and seafood door to door in South Central. And this is like, I think, 87, right in there, 86, 87, all day long. I'd bang on doors saying, meat man's here. Steaks, chops, slab bacon, country style, sliced a little bit thicker than normal. Shrimp, de-shelled, de-veined, delicious. I said, I even have religious lobster tails. You know why? Because when you see them, you're going to say, good Lordy, look at those tails. I did that every day, all day. My goal was to sell 10 boxes of meat or 10 buyers, whatever came first. And some days it would be approaching dark and I hadn't sold a single box of meat. And I would go into the gas stations to use the bathroom and I would kneel down in front of the sink and I'd say, "Dear Lord, please help me. If you could give me a sale, Lord, I'd sure appreciate it." And I never went home without selling 10 boxes of meat or 10 buyers. And sometimes after I got up, many times after I got up and continued banging on doors to sell the meat, one person would buy 10 boxes. And I always made it. I had a, and I, all this while, for this year and a half that I'm doing this, I'm still going to meetings. I'm still working out. I joined Nautilus. I go to church. And I would go to church every day and donate 10% and put it in this like tubular poor thing for poor people. Not realizing I'm one of those poor people. Anyway, you know, no, I wasn't. I was blessed beyond measure. I knew what was right. And I always wanted my mantra. One of my mantras, one of my affirmations, the greater reward always comes from doing the right thing. And I wanted to live by that. So I had heard at one of the AA meetings, Miller Beer was looking for a salesman, and people knew that I had been worked for Coors, worked for Bud, and the Miller distributorship, Beauchamp Distributing, still there. In Compton, I went down and interviewed. I told them immediately, I said, "I'm in recovery. I said, I've been to prison. I've been out now a while." And I said, "I go to AA meetings and Cocaine Anonymous and I did real well at Coors and Bud. I know I can do well for you too, but I don't drink, period, ever. And I don't do drugs." And they said, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "Well, I work at Philly Meats in Gardena." And they were familiar. And they said, "Selling meat door to door." They said, "How long have you been doing that?" I said, "A year and a half." They said, you're hired. And I got a company car with them, and I got an expense account, which was $15 a week to buy lunch or, you know, coffee or with customers. And I went to work and I worked there a year. There's a whole lot more to it in that year, but time constraints, I did really well. They increased sales dramatically. If there was a contest, I won it. I went to Hawaii, whatever they had, I won. I walked out of a Ralph's Market on Santa Monica Boulevard one day. I looked at the sidewalk. I said, "You know what? I'm going to get the concession to clean all these sidewalks. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but that's what I'm going to do." It was like the light bulb went off in my brain. And I left there. I saw this this steam cleaning machine removing the white lines off Santa Monica Boulevard. And I called the 800 number on the side of the machine. The guy who answered, Ron, said, "It's my machine. I leased it to the construction company. If you want it, I'll sell it to you." And I said, "I do want it. Yeah, I'll take it." I said, "But you'll have to, if we could split the payment up in increments of like 3 months, I can do it." I bought that machine. And he said, "You know, I bought this as a franchise. If you can get yourself down to Orlando and put yourself up at a Motel 6, you can learn all about the machine at this school that they have." So I did that. I took a week off. I went down to Orlando. Went to this school and learned everything this machine can do. And one of them is clean new brick. And when I was out selling Miller, I was in North Long Beach and I drove past this building that was being built all brick. I called the 800 number on the side of the machine. I said, "Do you have anybody to clean your new brick?" He said, "No, I've been looking." I said, "Well, I can do that." And he said, "How much do you charge?" And I looked up in my little handbook and I can't remember exactly what it was. It was like, say, $10 per 100 brick. And he said, "Well, that's $750. He said, "When can you start?" I said, "Well, at the most 2 weeks, but maybe sooner. I'll let you know." He said, "Okay." I went in and gave notice at Miller, and not realize that when you're a salesman, if you give notice, that you're let go that day. Gave notice, told them what I was going to do. They wished me well. I got the machine. That was my first job. $750 took me 3 days, and I made $750. And the supplies weren't that much at all. And that started me on that road. And I named my business HydroClean. You know, did it the right way. Got an accountant the right way. Tax ID number. When I got my accountant, his name was Fred Stevens, I said, Fred, look, I've been to prison already. Don't ever want to go back. We don't ever need to take any gray area deductions, only deductions that are true. He said, Jim, no problem. He says, that's the way I operate. And we had a relationship for years and years and years, years, the whole time I was in business. I went on with that business to eventually, I think it was 3 or 4 years later, get the majority of the sidewalks with Ralph's. I also got all the Wells Fargo's, Jack in the Boxes, Denny's. I also cleaned all the cranes that lift the containers on and off the rail cars at the rail yards. I had 2 60-foot boom trucks that I purchased over time that I could clean the whole crane in a day. It was $2,400 in one day. Of course, my truck was filthy, but that was fine. It's just part of work, you know? And I did that job and owned that business for 25 years. I had 5 trucks, 2 boom trucks, numerous guys that worked for me. One guy stayed with me the whole time, Felix. And we're still in contact today, and I just love Felix. And when I left, I gave him $10,000 and a truck and a machine. And when I sold the business, and he's still doing it to this day. Another great guy that was part of the team was Gonzalo. And he did the high-rise windows. It was just a great business, and I really enjoyed it. My final 10 years of doing it, I did almost zero work. And Felix had gotten so good, he did the estimating. And Gonzalo needed zero, look-see. Gonzalo, he just turned him loose. He knows exactly what to do. Don't get in his way. I sold the business in 2012. In the meantime, I had bought a building in Signal Hill in 1999, an office building that had 3 lots next door. I needed the 3 lots because we needed to store our equipment and our trucks. And the office building was a derelict. Animals lived in it, homeless, got everybody out, including the animals. The animals were trickier than the humans. Fixed the building up, and I rented it for $1,500 a month, and it stayed rented the whole time I owned it. The 3 lots next door, I ended up buying 2 more lots next door to that. And we built a 5-unit warehouse office building. And all those got rented out. And it was a beautiful building. One of the guys in AA, Jim, was an architect. He designed the building. And I made friends, and I treated people with respect and dignity wherever I went. And so I had made a lot of friends in the trades because of the work that I did. We ended up, listen to this, at 8 years sober, this is a huge life changer for me. 8 years sober, I had seen this girl in AA. Her name was Susan. I always thought, man, she's beautiful and she's strong. And she has, when she shares in meetings, she shares with authority and conviction. And I really respected her and admired her. And I thought, of course, she's got a boyfriend and her husband. And I just let that go. I go to Hoff's Hut. It's no longer there in Belmont Shore. And I used to take a guy by the name of Bob, who I sponsored, and I'm still in contact with Bob, and go to Hoff's Hut for dinner. And here is Susan with this gal named Lisa, who we're still friends with today, who Lisa was sponsoring, or Susan was sponsoring Lisa and taking her to dinner at Hoff's Hut. And Lisa was 19 years old. We kept running into each other to the point of like, this is like, anyway, the last time we ran into each other, we hugged and she gave me a kiss. And I just thought, okay, yeah, well, that's pretty nice. I said to the waitress on my way out of there, I said, listen, I'm going to buy those girls dinner right there. I said, anonymously. She said, okay, gotcha. I'm leaving. The waitress doesn't say anything, but this other waitress says to her, hey, that guy just bought your dinner. And she runs over to me and says, if you're going to buy my dinner, I want the pleasure of your company. I said, absolutely. You know, and so to get her number, I called Miles Evans because I knew he had a roster of numbers. I got her number, called her, and Miles says, by the way, I need a speaker for East Bay, which is this huge Sunday night meeting, Long Beach. So I said, sure, I'll be your speaker. And so I called Susan, invited her to dinner. It was Ragazzi Restaurants, no longer there. I said, to get your number, I'm the speaker at East Bay. She says, fabulous. She said, I'll be right in the front row. And if I'm not mistaken, I think she led the meeting that night. She heard my story And she loved that I was like bad boy gone good. And when I say good, I mean all the way good. You know what I mean? I did not want any part of that old life at all. We went out. We had a nice time. I said to her, Susan, what are you looking for? And she said to me, she says, Jim, I'm looking for a committed love relationship with the end product to be marriage. And I thought, fabulous. Somebody who actually has the wherewithal to say exactly what they want. I said, you know what? That's exactly what I'm looking for, too. I said, let's find out if that's us. You know what I mean? Let's date. Let's see each other. I don't forget this. I asked her out after that. I said, do you want to go out Friday night? She said, well, I have plans. I said, look, Susan, okay, good. You got plans. If we're going to see what happens here, you have to be available for me, okay? Because I work like a mofo. And, so you have to make time for me if you want to see me. She says, well, Friday night after 7, I'm free. I said, done. 4 months later, we got married. 4 months. And we made sure that God was number one in our lives. She was as committed as I was to not repeating the old lifestyle of immediately sleeping with somebody. No, we want to do it differently. We want to wait till we're married. I also told her, I said, I think it's very important that once we do get married, we find a church that we both enjoy and we go committed to the church. She says, I'm with you. I'm your partner. And we've never stopped doing that. 32 years later, we've never stopped doing that. The church has always provided us with ways to serve, you know, whether it's starting AA meetings or celebrating recovery or ministering to other families who have alcoholics or kids who are drug addicts and or husbands or wives, whatever you name it. It's all about giving back. God has blessed us tremendously in our lives. Susan worked with Levi Strauss. She was the top salesman in the nation with Levi Strauss, and for good reason. I mean, she is exceptional. She's an exceptional woman in literally every way. And I definitely mirrored above my station. And I'm so grateful that she saw the worth of me, you know. And now, all these years later, we bought property. We self-managed property. We've had Airbnb in Long Beach. It's unbelievable what we've been able to accomplish. And with really not being overly intentional about it, but then gaining more intentionality that we have to like prepare for our future. And we've now lived in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. We are committed to AA. I'm going to a meeting noon. I'm having lunch with a guy from there at noon today. Susan still sponsors Lisa. I still have contact with Bob. Bob decided to go out and test the waters again. But thank God he made it in before he died. And I think he has a couple of years of sobriety now. And we talk every now and then, and I'm happy for him. But God, the life that we've given is a miracle, what we have. It's a miracle. The house we live in is paid for. The rentals that we have here are paid for. We're able to bless the church. We're able to bless the kids of church, providing scholarships to camp. And also Christian Ministries provides Leaders Academy for young adults. We're able to anonymously give to them for their tuition for the year, because they live on campus for 9 months out of the year at Leaders Academy. I just cannot tell you how grateful I am for absolutely every single day. I love the program. I love AA. I love my wife. We like each other. We really like each other. I love being with her. When I'm not with her, I miss her. And she feels the same about me. And all of this would not be possible were it not for Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps, which I have worked and worked numerous times and worked the first 3 steps some days before noon. The 12 steps and the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you apply them to your life, you cannot help but have a good life. And I think I'll leave you with that. Thank you so much for letting me share with you, and I wish you all the best. God bless.
Thank you, Jim, for your story. You are a great storyteller and remember so much detail.
I know. My wife always says that too. I mean, I do. You know, I practice transcendental meditation. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-mm, no.
I practice transcendental meditation. I learned it in the early 70s. Of course, I got away from it when the drugs and alcohol set in. But then once I was in prison, I started meditating again. Transcendental meditation takes you back in your mind. You kind of like relive these circumstances and episodes of your life during meditation. You feel everything that you felt. You see everyone that was there. You remember everything about it. And whatever stress was created, positive or negative, during that episode that you are now seeing in your mind is released from you. So for the past 38 years, I've traveled my whole life. You know, I traveled Vietnam many times with the ship blowing up, you know, to the point now where I don't even think about it anymore, you know. And so it's benefited me greatly, the meditation.
Sounds very healing.
It is. You can check it out online, Transcendental Meditation.
I appreciate that. I also really appreciate your service.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Did I mention I just got back from a reunion with the guys yesterday afternoon? We all met in Tempe, Arizona. There's not many of us left. We all met in Tempe. And it's always good to get together with them. When I see them as 19 and 20 years old rather than what we truly are. But it's always good to get together with them. But thank you so much, Tara, for that. Thank you.
What is the Code of Men? You mentioned the Code of Men when you were reading the Old West novels up in Canada.
Oh, yeah. The Code of, Louis L'Amour novels. The Code of Men is that when something would be done wrong to someone in the family or somehow, some way, the code is the cattle get taken in, the cattle get taken to market, the milk cows get fed, the horses get shod. Whatever's going on at the farm or the ranch gets taken care of. And then we go into town and set things right that were made wrong. So it's like you never shirk your duty. Duty comes first, and then you can set right whatever was made wrong. And the men then always acted in integrity and authenticity and with honor, you know. And I wanted to be that.
I think you are that. You are that.
Thank you, Tara. Thank you.
You worked to exactly that, Jim.
Thank you. Yeah.
Or maybe it was always there.
I don't know about, no, it wasn't always there. It is now because I betrayed people in the past. When you're in the throes of alcohol and drugs, you do betray people either openly or inadvertently, but you let people down all the time. You know, I mean, you just do. I sure did.
Yeah.
I would get invited to things and not show up and say I'd be there and I wouldn't be there. And, you know.
It's not you now.
No. That's right. Yeah.
And I will note that your wife is episode 187. So you spoke about her and listeners can listen to her story if they haven't already.
Thanks, Tara.
Is there anything
that
you're thinking, anything that you're thinking of now that you'd like to share?
The first thing that came to my mind, Tara, was Jesus is the way. You know, here's a funny story. When I was in Bowdoin Penitentiary, I signed up to get visitors because, of course, I was out of the country. I did not get visitors. So I signed up with the guard and I said to the guard, I says, who visits me? Is it like, are these Jump for Jesus people? and he said, you know what? He probably didn't call me pal. That's one of my favorite pet words. He says, you know what, Jim? He says, the average citizen out there could give two shits about you, pal. It's the Jesus people that come and visit you. And that shut me up right then and there. And I'll never forget this one couple that visited me. They were probably our age, my age, mine and Susan's age, or even possibly younger. But he wore the Oshkosh overalls. He was a farmer. And I'll never forget, he had this handkerchief that was boogied up. And him and his wife were the kindest, most loving people to me. And they visited me regularly. I will never forget them, and I can still see them in my mind's eye. When I would see people like this, I would say, I want to be them. That's who I'm going to be. And now I get to do that. And I will be speaking in jail, or not speaking, but taking an AA meeting into jail here, either this week or next week. I'm not sure. But that'll become a regular deal for me. Yeah. Yep.
Jump for Jesus. I love that.
Yes.
Side note. I believe everybody should have their own spiritual path, whatever works for them. But for me, when I got sober, Jesus was my avenue. And I was actually baptized 7 years ago today.
Oh, my Lord. Good for you. God bless you, honey. I'm happy for you. I really am. That's awesome. Yeah.
I have a saying, if Jesus wants you, he will track you down and there is no getting away.
That is so true, Tara. So true, honey. I'll tell you, he came to jail and got me. And I'll never forget Father Pat said, Father Pat had told me that he was riding in a car with some friends. And he said he rode past the Calgary Remand Center, which is what it was. And he said to his friends, he said, Jesus is in there. Hmm. And he sure was, you know, saved my life.
Made you a good man, saving others now. You work for him. That's what you
said
when you did your prayer. You had a sense of, all right, you work for me now. Let's go.
Exactly. That's the message I got, Tara, was you're working for me now. Everything's going to be okay. Yeah.
The greater reward always comes from doing the right thing.
Yes. Yeah. I wrote that down. It was an affirmation. And I live by that.
It's beautiful. Final question for the alcoholic or addict out there still suffering. What final message would you like to leave with them?
I would say do not wait for yourself to lose absolutely everything, including all your teeth and all your health. Stop now. Go to meetings, throw yourself into meetings, and get help. Just go. You don't need to end up in the streets or the gutter. And you already know you have a problem. See, that's the deal. You know you have a problem. Stop now and get to meetings. Change your life. You will never regret it.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.